This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Jim Sheridan is best known for directing, writing, and producing movies inspired by the history and politics of his native Ireland. His films include My Left Foot, The Field, In the Name of the Father, The Boxer, Some Other Son, and Agnes Brown. His new film, however, is based largely on his own life. In America draws on experiences Sheridan had when he moved with his family from Ireland to New York City in the 1980s. It's about a husband and wife who have two young daughters. They come to New York still grieving the loss of their third child, Frankie, who died of a brain tumor. Here's a clip. In this scene, the girls have just been given an award at their school for the best homemade Halloween costumes. As they walk home with their parents, one of the girls throws her award in the trash.
Ah, you can't throw away your prize. Best homemade costume.
They made it up because they pity us.
You got it because you're different.
We don't want to be different. We want to be the same as everybody else.
Why would you want to be the same as everybody else?
But everybody else goes trick-or-treating.
What's that?
It's what they do here for Halloween.
What do you mean, like have the Halloween party?
No, not help the Halloween party. You don't ask for help in America, you demand it. Trick or treat, you don't ask, you threaten.
You can't do that in our street.
Why not?
Because you can't threaten drug addicts and transvestites, that's why.
What are transvestites?
Man dresses up as a woman.
For Halloween?
No, all the time. All the time.
Why?
It's just what they do here, okay?
Jim Sheridan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Yeah, great. It's good to be back.
This film is so much more directly autobiographical than your previous movies. What made you decide to tell this story now?
I've been working on it for about 10 years, more, since My Left Foot. And I wrote a couple of drafts because the stories were quite funny and the anecdotes were great. And then I gave it to my daughters because I didn't have a theme, thinking maybe they'd come up with a theme for a film. And what they did was eliminate my character from their stories.
That's so telling.
Yes, I disappeared, and I was just a guy who embarrassed them by turning up at school with a plastic bag on his head when it was raining, and sang the words to songs he didn't know, and when I had a few drinks, I'd tell them I loved them. And that was about it. That was my role in the family. And it was a kind of humbling experience. So I took the kids' perspective and put that with my own. But I still didn't have a story. And then I decided to incorporate the story of my brother who died. But I transferred it to my son and gave the emotions of myself to the daughter in the film. And I realized when I did it that it gave me a dual perspective on myself and my daughter. And without that, you know, you've got these flat personalities because it's very hard to write about yourself.
The story takes place after Frankie, the family's third child, who's only 5 years old, has died of a brain tumor. And mm-hmm. You dedicate the film to your brother, Frankie. Who died also of a brain tumor when he mm-hmm. was young. How old were you when your brother passed away?
I was 17 and he was 10 in actuality. He fell down the stairs when he was about 7 or so. And he, you know, he had a big black head and he recovered. But it had caused a tumor in his brain which nobody detected. And that became, you know, that grew like octopus-like. And when they opened him up, it was too deep to save him.
Were you able to spend much time with your brother during his illness?
Yeah. In a way, I often think I was the first to realize there was something wrong with him because out of the blue, I took him to the pictures and bought him a ice cream called a Knickerbocker Glory. And, you know, it's one with a long spoon and about 10 colors with a cherry on top. And I always remember him smiling at me. And for years, I thought, wasn't it great I brought him out to get him an ice cream when I'd never brought any of my brothers to anything. And gradually I realized that it was his smile I remembered because it wasn't actual. And, you know, the human face has 800 muscles. And the only thing that we can't do consciously is make a true smile. That seemingly the conscious mind can't smile unless it's actually authentic, deeper. And so false smiles are like that thing you see without the eye muscles engaged. Now, I knew when he was smiling at me, as I was saying knicker and bocker, that he was actually smiling, but it looked probably like something else. So I don't know how, but it stayed with me that maybe at that moment I knew subconsciously something was wrong.
So this was before, this was after the accident, before any diagnosis had been made?
Yeah, before any he starts slowing down slightly, like his motor functions just slightly got impaired. And my mother brought him to the doctor, and the doctor said, you better take him to hospital.
Well, in the film, the father, Johnny, he struggles not only financially to support his family, he's trying to get work as an actor in New York, but he also has trouble emotionally. He just can't feel anything since the loss of his son. And he says in one scene that he's just a ghost. How did your father deal with the loss of your brother, of his son? And did he retreat into his work?
He was always retreated into his work. My father got up at 8:30. He went to work at 9:00. He came back at 6:00. He got his tea. He went to work at 7:30. He came back at 11:00. I met a man on a train recently, and he was looking at me, and my wife said, don't make eye contact, because what would happen is I go over and talk to him, and he would tell me the story of, you know, everybody comes up to you and says, you should make a story about our street. And I go, yeah, and they say, Mrs. O'Brien in number 10, she had 12 kids. The eldest went off to the war, and you'd have to listen to the story of the 12 kids, and then they'd inevitably be saying, if you think that's mad, Mrs. Tittle next door, she had 14 kids, and you'd have to listen to those stories. So you with great fear, you make contact. So this man, I went over to him as the train was pulling in, and he said to me, you know, I worked for your dad. I worked with your dad in the GNR, which was the Great Northern Railway. He said, and in the morning, we'd sell tickets to Galway and Belfast. And at lunchtime, we'd go down to the old folks, and he was Dean Martin and I was Frank Sinatra. So my father went to work in the morning. At lunchtime, he organized the old folks. He came back at 6:00. He worked Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, and Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, he did the old folks or the drama group or the plan given for the church. And on Saturday during the morning, he brought the children from the Sheriff Street to the play, to the Bats. So he never stopped.
What was it like directing this film in which you're directing a character that's partially based on your father and also on you? What did you say to this actor, Paddy Considine, who plays
I didn't,
his part?
I didn't put anything on him, you know. I just let him build a character, you know, from the words and actions. I didn't have him imitate me, but...
Did you in fact say, don't watch me, don't imitate me?
No, all actors watch the director. Most actors are the director. You know, because, like, although John Wayne doesn't look like John Ford, he's actually playing John Ford. So, there is a there's an osmosis or symbiosis or whatever the osis is that happens, you know? But playing my father was weird because sometimes I would be pointing at the screen and say, that's exactly what my father would do. And it was actions that I had actually done. Do you know what I mean?
Can you give us an example?
Well, playing for the, trying to win the E.T. doll. When I lost that story. I lost the money.
Now, you're talking about in the film, the family has left the apartment building because it's so hot, and they go to the movies, and they see E.T., and then they walk through the streets of New York, and they end up at walking through an Italian street fair, like the Festival of San Gennaro or something, and they... Yeah. The daughter sees an E.T. doll and she wants it, and so the father bets pretty much everything, the rent money, everything, to win this doll, throwing balls into a basket.
Yeah.
That happened?
Yeah, that happened. Because my kid wanted it, so I was going to win it, and I got up to only $16 or $32, and I had 7 balls to get in the hole, and I'd got 6 of them. And I got up to 128 and I still only had 6. But I would point at that scene and say that's exactly like my father, because what gives it the tension is not quite just the father trying to win it. It's the daughter's attitude towards the gambling, you know? And that's really my attitude towards my father. He used to go to the races, and at the races he had to win, you know? Because if he won, it meant he was right about everything in life. And if he lost, it meant he was a complete idiot, you know? And he would behave in completely irrational terms if he didn't win. Like, he mightn't switch the heat on in the car going home. He was just crazy about that stuff. And he was a very loving guy, but, you know, the races meant a hell of a lot to him.
But you stopped, it sounds like. You didn't win when you bet. You got up to $128 and then you walked away?
No, I lost.
You lost, right.
Yeah, and I had $2 left. But what I mean, it's disconcerting to be still blaming your father at my age for actions that you took yourself in your life. So, you know, it just proves that I have this saying, everybody either blames their mother or their father, you know? And great actors blame both.
I want to be sure that we talk about the two actors who play the role of the young sisters in the film. They are sisters themselves, Sarah and Emma Bolger. They're fantastic. They're just so natural.
Yeah.
When you began to cast the film, did you have that in mind? Maybe that we could do that. I'll cast sisters.
No. What happened was, I went into the room looking for somebody to play my daughter, the 6-year-old. And I saw this angelic face. And I'd written the other part older because it was very complex. And I asked the 6-year-old to read the part, and I didn't know why I thought she could read, never mind act. And she read it perfectly, and I went, oh my God. Maybe she'd be precocious and horrible, you know? And so I said, I'll ask another kid. So I went over to my daughter and said, is there anybody else here? And she said, that kid. And I asked the other kid to read it. And as she was reading it, my coat was yanked from behind. And I turned round, and Emma was looking at me with a look of pity, as if I'd crossed some invisible line of etiquette that I wasn't aware of. And she just said to me, Jim. And I said, yeah. And she said, is she reading my part? And I went, well, I was going to say, this is an audition. I was going to say, this is the way we do it. I was going to say, I'm sorry for, you know, maybe you shouldn't read. But I couldn't say any of it because I didn't want to break her belief. So I just stared at her to see would she flinch and break eye contact, which she didn't do. And I realized there was a little bundle of self-esteem standing in front of me. So I found myself saying, even though I knew it was the very first odd day of auditions and the very first child, I said, nobody's reading your part, you're cast. And without a beat, she said, my sister's downstairs in the car. And I said, what age is she? And she said, 10. And I said, too young. And she said, well, you should see her anyway. So I went downstairs, met her, decided to rewrite the script, cast her. I didn't have to rewrite the script. She was so good. And on the first day of shooting, you know, I thought I'd get back into control on the set. And I went, action, something went wrong, and I went, cut. And the 10-year-old came out of the crowd and said, Jim, can I have a word? And I went, yeah. And she said, it's okay to curse in front of me. I'm 10, but my sister is only 6, and it's rude to curse in front of her. So I'm going to have to ask you to stop. So I was like, yeah. So I said, that's not going to happen. So she kept staring at me, and I said, well, the only way out of this is that you'll have to take over and say action, and Emma can say cut whenever you want. And that's the way we did the film. And it was very interesting because there was no difference between acting and non-acting, reality and the set and whatever. But behind it, I've become to, maybe it's just getting back into my headspace. I kind of think there's a rage in me that wants to put the child back in control of the parents. are back in control of the adults, not the parents.
So did you have any of those problems that other directors have with kids on the set, that you have to make it more like play and keep it light and make the set a fun place?
Not really. I don't believe in that stuff. I think, you know, when people say don't work with children or animals, it's like, yeah, I get you. You know, it's such a sick sentence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just betrays their feelings that children should be kept in their place, you know. They should be muted emotionally and grow up, like, messed up, you know. And I think that you're better off just, you know, those kids forced me to be honest. So rather than, like, the set is like I didn't have balloons or anything, you know, but well, the difficulty was when I was 2 weeks behind, Emma would ask me, what's for dinner, Jim? And I'd say, I think it's burgers. And she'd say, and is the white beans on today? And I'd be like, I think so. Yeah, she says, I like them, but what are they called? And I'm like, I don't know. And she'd go, and what are the red things with the strings? And I'd go, cranberries. And they were the kind of conversations I had to have. And it's very hard to have light conversations about reality when you're stressed out, you know?
Huh.
So it's actually a question of not saying, oh, God, we keep the kids happy and light and play. And it's more a question of respecting them as much as any adult or more. And imagining that, you know, the potential of a person reaches back all the way into the conception, you know?
And letting them be who they are. Which is also children.
Yeah, letting them be who they are. It's like, it's the kids in this film are magical. The Sam Martin's fantastic, Paddy's great, Jaimin's great, and the kids are magical, and we all knew that, and we all stepped out of the way, you know. It's like when you have a holy thing happening, you don't mess with it.
Jim Sheridan's new film, In America, opens November 26th.